Dr. Matera, she has got an incredible background. She started out here at the University of Washington and got her bachelor's degree in course resources. And then she went on to Yale University in her School of Forestry for graduate work, and then went to Harvard University for her PhD. And she studied carbon and water exchange in the Amazonian rainforest, and that's what she's going to talk about today. Right now, she came back to Seattle, they lured her back, and she's a research scientist and laboratory manager for the Urban Ecology Research Lab with Marina Alberti right here on campus. And she's looking at characterizing and quantifying the environmental consequences of urbanization and land use change. So she has a fascinating, exciting background. I told her to be as open and candid as possible with you about what it's like making the transition from being a graduate student to doing research out in the real world and coming back and being a research scientist and lab manager. So let's offer a warm welcome to Dr. Matera.
So what I'm going to talk about is the research I did for my PhD, and it was a lot of fun, I have to say. I was able to combine a lot of forest ecology and the things that I studied here as an undergraduate, and also learn a lot of new things about atmospheric sciences and global warming and the carbon cycle. So I came to one of these seminars last week, and all the questions were saved to the end, and I think it's a lot more fun to talk to you guys rather than just talk at you. So please interrupt me if something's unclear or you want me to elaborate. But yeah. So I'll start out by giving you a little bit of scientific background and talk a bit about the Amazon and the nature of the problems and challenges there as they relate to the carbon and water cycle. And I'll talk about the controls on net ecosystem exchange of carbon dioxide. I'll talk about the controls on photosynthesis and respiration. And then I'll look a little bit about the role of water limitation in these ecosystems, which is a very timely issue if you've followed any of the politics of the area. And then since we're in the forestry school, I'll talk a little bit about logging and what's going on there and what it means for the carbon cycle, or at least one small example of what it could mean. So this is a slide that all of you, I'm sure, have seen ad nauseum. But this is showing atmospheric CO2 increasing as measured at Mauna Loa. And there's a lot to see in this graph. You could see, you know, the increase. You could see the seesaw pattern of the leaves coming on and off the trees, and that's all very interesting. But it's a little more interesting, to look at it this way, I think. So the red line at the top there, what you see is the fossil fuel emissions. So you can see that there's been a steady increase through time in the amount of carbon that we're emitting to the atmosphere. And then the square up and down here in the black line is the amount of carbon that's actually accumulating in the atmosphere. So there's a big difference between the rate of emissions and the rate of accumulation. And that green area there in the middle is what's referred to as the missing carbon sink. And if we could understand what's controlling that missing carbon sink and where it's going and why it's going where it is and perhaps how to make it bigger or how to keep it there, it's a very big question. Currently, it's believed that about half of the carbon is going into the ocean, which I'm not really going to talk about at all, and the other half is going into the terrestrial biosphere. And where in the terrestrial biosphere is a very contentious question. Many people believe it's in northern latitudes, in portions of the eastern United States that have been deforested and are now going back. Other people say it's in the Amazon or in the northern boreal forests or so forth. But there's a lot at stake. Now, these little arrows here at the bottom, those denote El Niño years. And you can see that there's a pretty strong correlation between the years that more of the carbon accumulates in the atmosphere and those El Niños. And part of that is due to the ocean components, but part of it is also due to what happens in the tropics. So in the tropics, during El Niño years, it tends to be hot and dry, or hotter and drier. And there's a lot of fires that occur in those years. So, for example, in the 1998 fire, which is one of the biggest, the years where we had the most carbon accumulating in the atmosphere, there were enormous fires across the Amazon and across Indonesia. So there's a lot of linkages between ocean effects, atmospheric effects and then what happens in the terrestrial. So there's a lot of coupling to think about here. So this is a slide that overlays the Amazon basin in the United States just for scale. It's big, and it's a big player in the global carbon cycle. So the terrestrial rainforests cover about 12% of the Earth's surface. So it's not that large of an area. But these forests, they contain half of the world's terrestrial carbon. So carbon that's stored in trees, anything above ground. Half of that is in the tropics. Half of that is in the Amazon. So the Amazon alone is holding a quarter of the carbon that's really readily accessible. So any changes that happen in the Amazon are really, like, they have very significant effects globally. And there's a nice, pretty picture of what it looks like. And I just will put up a couple of facts at a glance, which actually I stole from Dan Nepstad. But the Amazon basin covers about 7 million square kilometers, and it holds about a quarter of the world's species. So from a biodiversity perspective, it's also really important. 20% of the world's fresh water flows through there, with the Amazon being, of course, the largest river. Deforestation is a big component there. About 18,000 square kilometers get deforested every year. It's currently about 16 or 17% deforested, and that number is continuing to increase. There's a lot of people that live there. It's not just a pristine place that is nice and untouched except for where they've logged. There's about 30 million people living there, and about 20 million of those are indigenous, and it covers several countries, but most of it is in Brazil. So, as I alluded to earlier, one of the big questions is the Amazon a sink or a source for carbon? And it's an important question in terms of what we do in terms of our emissions and how much we feel in terms of the effects of our driving and our lifestyles. And it's controversial. I guess that most people are leaning towards it's a sink, maybe, but not too big of a sink and not all the time, but it looks like it's a sink, at least for now. And it's incredibly contentious, but that's where things are now. What is not contentious is that it's a big player. This is a MODIS image from space. It's based on observations from space, estimating the net primary productivity globally. And you can see the tropics pop out in there, with the Amazon in particular. So regardless if it's a source or a sink, it's a very big player. And the next question is, if it is a carbon sink, is it stable? Is it likely to stay that way? Is it likely to stay forest? And unfortunately, the picture right now is not so optimistic. The quote I have up there is from the IPCC, which they highlight Amazonia emerges as an especially vulnerable ecosystem with significant risks from drought, climate-induced forest dieback, and wildfire. And the picture I have here on the bottom is from a paper by Peter Cox, which was the first one to get people very worried about this problem. And what he did is he ran a coupled ocean atmosphere global circulation model, and he predicted how things were going to, what the land signal, what the ocean signal, and so forth was going to look like in the future. And you could see that here it started in the 1800s and it projected out to 2100. And you could see that the carbon emissions continued to increase over time. Atmospheric accumulation continued to increase. The ocean sink in his model, not only continued, it seemed to get stronger over time, which is something that not a lot of people necessarily agree with right now. But the land part of this, that we had a land sink for much of the 1900s going into the 2000s, by about 2050 it turned. And the land stopped taking up carbon and started releasing carbon. So it was amplifying the problems that we already had in terms of emissions. And most of that carbon, most of the reason that it turned was because of the Amazon. So in his model simulations, the Amazon collapsed. So the Amazon took a shift from being an ecosystem like this, which is a very tall stature, green, lush, you know, all everything that you picture for the tropics, to this, which is holds very little carbon, is fire-driven, and they have savannas or cerrados like this across Brazil, but they're in the southern fringes. This isn't what most of the Amazon looks like. Most of it looks like this. But if Peter Cox's projections are correct, a lot of it could look like this. So it's those initial model simulations got a lot of people very, very worried. But since then, not all the models agree, which tends to be the case with anything related to climate change. So this is a whole suite of different models. And this was a model intercomparison done where they ran all the models with the same driver data, and then they tried to see how the models behaved. And you can see here, I haven't identified all of them, but I did identify Peter Cox's Hadley Center model here. It's an outlier amongst the suite of models, but that doesn't mean that it's right or wrong. But not all of the models are projecting the same thing. But a lot of the problem that we have with answering these questions about the carbon cycle in Amazonia is that we don't have a good grasp on these fundamental questions. And the reason is that we really just don't have an understanding of the mechanisms that are controlling the exchange. And if we don't understand the mechanisms as they are now, we don't have much hope of understanding how they're going to change in the future. So this is another MODIS image that I've put up here of the Amazon, and it looks really quite uniform, I think. There's a few patches there that pop out as being a little lusher and others that are a little drier, but when you look at it this way, it does look fairly uniform, and the models treat it fairly uniformly. But that's not really the case. What I've put up here are some maps of precipitation. So Seattle gets less than a meter of rain a year. The driest places in the Amazon get more than that. The driest places here in the southern fringes, which is where you do have that savanna-like vegetation, get more rain than Seattle. And the range here goes to well over 3 meters of rain, which means that it's raining pretty much every day all the time. And that's what you tend to get here in the western Amazon. And not only is there this huge variability from 1 to well over 3 meters of rain, there's a big difference in how the rain comes, where some portions have a very strong but very short dry season. Other places have a little less seasonality, or here, for example, where there's rain coming throughout the year. There's still a big seasonal peak, but there's rain throughout the year. And this slide here shows the length of the dry season. You can see the differences where in the southern part here, the dry season goes for about 7 months, and over here, there's really no dry season. And what I mean by dry season, not that there's no rain, but that the rain is less than 100 millimeters a month, which is a magic number in for the atmosphere, because that's what the estimates are, that the potential rate of evapotranspiration, so water that's exchanged through either evaporation or through the leaves, that's the potential evapotranspiration. So if you have less than that, it's suggesting you have a water deficit that the plants will feel. At least that's what was suggested in the 1970s when that number was delineated. So there's a lot of variability. And these numbers that you see on both of these maps, those show where there have been extensive campaigns to try to measure some of these carbon and water exchange processes. So we worked at number 2, which I'm a little biased, but it's a particularly interesting place to work. It's in the 27th percentile for dryness. So it's not as wet as a lot of these other places, and in some respects, it's a forecast for what more of the Amazon might look like if the models are correct and it really does get drier. And there's these 6 sites where there have been a lot of observations. Unfortunately, the observations weren't all at the same time, done with the same methods. or equal quality measurements. So I'm really going to focus only on the measurements that we did, and I'll make a couple comparisons with what other people did. So this is where our site was located, which is near the city of Santarém. You can see the equator up here. And we worked in a national forest, which was protected, sort of. They didn't have rampant, uncontrolled logging going on there, but there was logging in some parts of it. People were still using it actively for hunting and collecting various fruits, but it was a little more protected than other parts. And this is a satellite image, so you can see here the Amazon River, and this is the Tapajós River, which is a small tributary. I think the Tapajós is the 7th biggest river in the world. So just a little tributary. And you can see the city here, and there's a small beach community here. And then this highway that you can see going through here is one of the major transportation routes in the Amazon for transporting beef and soybeans. And you can see that there's been a lot of development that has happened adjacent to the highway, and this is the protected national forest area here. So as the crow flies, we're about 5 kilometers from either the river or the road. And it was a lot of fun. When we first got there, it was quite an adventure. This is the road. And the jeeps are, I don't know if you can quite tell, they're underwater. So we ended up having to, so we drive through these river roads, and we killed a couple of these jeeps. And then they put snorkels on the jeeps so that we could drive there. But it was pretty remote, at least when we first got there. And it was an adventure. This was when we were actually going to set up the tower, which you can see here. So that we put up this tower, which is kind of like a cell phone tower. So it's a triangular, about a foot on each side tower. And we outfitted it with a whole bunch of instruments, which I'll zoom in a minute. And I've climbed up this tower more times than I want to count, and the view is pretty spectacular. It can be a little scary. But so it's 64 meters tall. The forest canopy is about 45 meters tall. And our main sampling point is here at 58 meters, and I'll zoom in on that. And just a couple of general characteristics. This particular site is very flat, which is very good for the technique that we used for measuring exchange. It's not very typical for the Amazon. Most of the Amazon has more topography than what this site has, but every site is atypical in some way. It was a closed canopy forest, and there were no signs of logging at this site anytime recently. It had all the characteristics of what you'd call primary or old growth. It had a lot of coarse woody debris. It had a lot of epiphytes. The vines were there, but not entirely dominating. The soils were clay, and the water table was very deep. The water table is about 100 meters deep here, and the roots of the plants go deep. They go 15, 20 meters, but they weren't able to access the water table, which is a pretty important feature. And like I said, the dry season here was about 5 months. So what we did is we measured something called eddy covariance. So we set up a sonic anemometer, which is what's pictured here. We measured the three-dimensional wind. So we measured the wind speeds 8 times a second, three-dimensionally. And in close proximity, we had a gas inlet where we measured water vapor and CO2 concentration. So by putting these very high-precision concentration measurements together with the three-dimensional winds, we could get an estimate of the flux out of the top of the forest. So this is this first term here, which is the eddy flux out of the top. And so those measurements were being made up here. In addition to that, you have to measure what's going on inside the canopy. So to do that, this is now looking up the tower, and you can see there's a lot of stuff to make climbing the tower challenging. We measured the profile concentration. So we had 8 levels going down the tower where we measured the concentration of CO2 and water. And then we measured the temperature and sunlight and rainfall and all those other things. But by putting together these profile measurements of how the gas concentrations were changing within the canopy, and then what was coming out of the top of our little imaginary box, we could get an estimate of the NEE, the net ecosystem exchange, of CO2 or of water. So by measuring the NEE, we could get at that first question that I started out with, is this forest a source or a sink for carbon? But NEE it's the net exchange. There's two parts that go into it. There's CO2 that is lost through respiration. So that includes autotrophic and heterotrophic respiration. So respiration by the plants as they're doing photosynthesis, and respiration by stuff on the ground, so soil respiration, litter decomposition, decomposition of the dead logs that are left behind. And then it includes carbon uptake through photosynthesis. So it's the difference between the uptake and the loss. So here's some data, finally, after a lot of preamble. So what I've plotted here, it's a little complicated, and I'll walk through this in a bunch of steps. But what I've plotted is the cumulative annual exchange. So it starts out at January 1st in every year, and then it goes from there. The positive numbers in my sign convention denote carbon source, so carbon going from the forest into the atmosphere. Negative numbers, carbon sink, carbon going from the atmosphere into the forest. And so what you can see in this top panel is that there's a big seasonality in here, but carbon tends to go out in the early part of the year and then turn later in the year. This bottom panel shows cumulative precipitation plotted for the same time periods in the same way, and you can see that, you know, it's going, and then once it gets to this kind of green area that I've highlighted here, that's the dry season. So that's where we still get rain, but less. And you can see that these curves tend to flatten out, but there's a lot of variability. So, the first thing I wanted to note was the strong seasonality, where we tend to lose carbon from the forest into the atmosphere in the early part of the calendar year when it's raining. And then when it stops raining, it tends to turn around and go the other way. And this was something that before we started making these measurements, we had no idea what this cycle looked like. In fact, all the models predicted it looked the other way around. They predicted that all the carbon was going to be lost during the dry season, because during the dry season there wasn't going to be enough water and the plants weren't going to be able to photosynthesize. Well, the opposite turned out to be true, that the plants were able to photosynthesize more during the dry season because they had more sunlight. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself. But so the seasonality is strong and was a surprise. We also found a tremendous amount of interannual variability, where this is over 3 tons of carbon per hectare per year, which is about 1.5% of the total carbon that's in a forest like that, which is a lot. So this is a tremendous amount of variability over these 4 years, and it also changes signs, where during 3 of the 4 years at this end point, which is where if you add up every day in that calendar year where you end up, 3 of the 4 years it was a source of carbon to the atmosphere, 1 of them it was a sink. So this is contrary to what I said when I started out, that most people seem to think the Amazon is a sink for carbon. Well, we found that it was a source for carbon, at least at this place in this time. And we also found a very strong sensitivity to what happened during the dry season. So in this year here, this blue year, which is 2003, I think, let's go back to 2002, which is here. So the dry season started in 2002. It was quite dry. There was a wet period in here, and then pretty dry. But the next year, in 2003, it didn't rain like it does normally. The rainy season didn't start when it was supposed to, you know, when it normally starts. And in that year, the forest, rather than losing carbon like it did in the years previous, it was taking up carbon. And it even was taking it up at a pretty good clip. As soon as it started raining, it shifted the other way. And this sensitivity just jumps out at you time and time again. And here in 2002, we had this dry period, we got a rainy patch, and immediately the forest responded. So during the rainy season, you get lots of carbon loss. If it rains during the dry season, you'll get a pulse of carbon coming out again. There's another example, and this one's actually kind of funny, because I went to a NASA meeting with a bunch of big shots, and I was presenting this stuff. And the director of this NASA program that funded us was very excited, because I thought I had, you know, I was showing these results that showed this forest going from a source to a sink. So we had a big carbon loss, a smaller carbon loss. This year went into a carbon sink. In 2005, when I presented it, it was about here. And it looked like we were going to have a tremendous sink. So we had the makings for a beautiful science cover story. Forest goes from source to sink, and then it started raining when it wasn't supposed to rain, and our story fell apart. So here, you know, this happened, I think, a week after I gave this talk and got a lot of people excited. It rained early, and that carbon sink that we were going to have that year disappeared, and we actually ended up having a decent-sized source. So there's a lot of sensitivity in this, but although these net numbers are really interesting, it's a little tricky to interpret because it's a small residual. These two numbers are the big ones. This one is the small one. And what the models tend to model is not the net exchange. Well, that's what they come out with in the end, but they model these component processes. And those are harder to measure, but we can make estimates of it. Because there's no photosynthesis at night, no sunlight, no photosynthesis. So we can, by treating the daytime and nighttime data separately, we could come up with estimates for the two. So let's look at what goes on with photosynthesis. So here I've plotted PAR, photosynthetically active radiation, and then here is the net exchange again. And I've color-coded or shape-coded the morning versus the afternoon. And you could see that there's a pretty big difference. In the morning, which is this black solid line here, so I put a line through those points, you see that there's a big increase in the carbon uptake, it's a negative number here, as the sunlight increases. And then in the afternoon, even at the same amount of sunlight, the forest can't do as much with it, and it comes back on a different trajectory. And then when we cross zero here, that's where the respiration part is stronger than the photosynthesis part as we get to really low lights. So light is clearly a big driver of photosynthesis. There's also a lot of seasonality in the photosynthesis. And so I color-coded here the wet season versus the dry season. And you can see that there's a cycle that's repeating here, but it's not so straightforward because the photosynthesis seems to go down. It seems to be higher in the wet season when there's less light because it's cloudy and it's raining. And then it reaches this minimum right as it's about to transition to the dry season when the light levels are going to go up, but the plants aren't going to have as much water. So there's a clear seasonality there, but it's a little confusing to figure out why it's doing what it's doing because both the light and the moisture change at the same time, and they change in tandem. If it's raining, it's not sunny. So to try to tease the moisture and light effects apart, I took this is the same curve of net exchange versus photosynthesis here, and I just took a pocket of data. So I just took a chunk of light, but not of high light, but not too high light data, and looked at it across the year. So I eliminated any effects of differences in incoming light to see what the moisture effects might be. And it was a little funny. There was a big signal here, but it didn't do what I expected it to do, where we seem to have maximum photosynthesis rates at a given light level in the middle of the wet season, and then a minimum early in the dry season, and then it turned around and went the other way. And again, none of the models that try to simulate this on a local or global scale have anything like this in them. And so we went out and we, in trying to figure out why it was doing this, we had installed a whole suite of forest biometry plots at this site, which I'll show a little more data from in a minute. But one of the things that we started monitoring on the ground was what was happening with the leaves in the canopy. And I've inverted the scale. So this is a lot of leaf litter fall, and this is a little bit of leaf litter fall. And there's a very strong correlation there, which we are surprised about. So although it's not rocket science, perhaps, once you have the data to look at it, but we saw that the photosynthesis rates started to decrease as the leaf litter fall rates started to increase. And so as the plants were getting ready to senesce their leaves, their photosynthetic efficiencies would go down. But this was not so obvious because this is an evergreen tropical rainforest. It's not a deciduous forest, and the lifetime of a leaf on the tree here is 3 years. So to see a signal this big from phenology in an aseasonal forest was a surprise. So the phenology of what's going on in the canopy was a big driver of the photosynthetic efficiency. On the other side, we have respiration. And like I mentioned, respiration is the sum of two components, autotrophic, the maintenance respiration of the plant, and then heterotrophic, the decompositional parts. And what we were able to measure is the total, but we can make some inferences about the two components as well. So the respiration has a similar strong seasonal signal as the other parts that I've shown. And it seems to decline here late in the wet season. So in time with what we were seeing in the photosynthesis. So the photosynthesis in the last slide and the respiration here, both of them start to decline as it's approaching the dry season. And we interpreted that as a decline in the autotrophic part of the respiration. So the plants are doing less photosynthesis and they're respiring less. And in the dry season, we seem to hit this minimum. So this part doesn't look like the photosynthesis curve I just showed, where it doesn't kick up in the early dry season. It seems to stay low, but there's a lot of variability. And we believe that's because the respiration can't proceed because there's not enough water. So there's two main drivers for decomposition of organic material. And one is temperature. It's hotter in the dry season. The other is moisture. It's drier in the dry season. So we believe that the reason that the respiration is inhibited here is because there's not enough water. And you could see that by some of the sensitivity that happens when we have an anomalously dry or wet period. So here in this first one, I've plotted daily precipitation down here, and these shaded parts are the dry season. The white parts are the wet season. So here we had a big precipitation event that lasted a couple of days, and the response was A, strong, and B, it lasted. This is two really big days of rain, and it lingered. It showed up in these monthly average signals for a long time. Here, in 2004, we had a really dry season, and the respiration was extremely low that year. Now, I said that there are two things that models use to try to predict respiration. One is moisture and the other is temperature. Well, I've shown that the moisture sensitivity is there in this site, but there's no temperature sensitivity. I spent weeks, my advisor refused to believe me that I couldn't find a signal. He was sure I was doing something wrong because every model for 100 years has had an exponential temperature function. So as the temperature increases, the respiration increases exponentially. There is no relationship here. I've since taken data from some of the other sites that I showed in the Amazon, and there's no relationship. So regardless of what's going on with temperature, moisture seems to be the dominant driver. So this is a comparison between another flux tower, which is near Manaus, and then our flux tower. So we are this first area there, and then Manaus is here. So Manaus is a little wetter and has a shorter dry season than we do, but it's not very far away. And surprisingly, the respiration at these two sites was almost identical. They have a much bigger error bar because they have some technical challenges that we don't have at this site, but the mean is really similar. And I broke it down and tried to look at where the respiration was coming from. So there's respiration that comes from the tree stems themselves, the wood respiring. There's leaf respiration. So the autotrophic leaf respiration as they're photosynthesizing. There's respiration from coarse woody debris. So just debris that's, you know, trees that have died and fallen down and are decomposing slowly. And then there's soil respiration. So this includes litter that's laying on the ground and the soil itself. And while the total respiration estimates at these two sites were remarkably similar, it came from different places. In particular, this coarse woody debris number was very different. And if we looked at this in a little more detail, this is a colleague of mine, our paper, that we just submitted recently, looking at what was happening inside the forest in the trees. What was the dynamics of tree growth, tree mortality in these two forests? So this is the Tapajós, the site where we worked, and then this Manaus site. And so what we did to get these numbers is we went out and measured thousands of trees repeatedly. I have no idea how many times I've climbed up a ladder and wrapped the tape around it, but it was fun. And we also measured the amount of this coarse woody debris, which is quite large. I mean, these trees can have 150 centimeters in diameter. When one of those trees falls down, A, you don't want to be anywhere near that because a lot of other things are going to fall down, but B, it's going to stay there for a little while. So here's one of the logs that you can see one of our field techs out there with us there for scale. It's about as tall as he is from the ground. So when we put all these measurements together of what was going on within the forest, so now it's totally independent from the last set of measurements where we're not looking from the atmosphere's perspective, but we're looking from the trees, you can see that this first blue bar is growth. So there was a lot of growth at both of these sites, both in the Tapajós and in Manaus. There was a lot of recruitment, so birth, new trees coming into our samples. We did this for 5 years, going annually, so we were able to see new trees come in. We saw a lot of death, mortality here. And we saw this green bar here is the amount of downed coarse woody debris and then standing coarse woody debris. And mortality is an input into the coarse woody debris. As a tree dies, it becomes this debris. And there was this huge difference between these two sites where the growth, recruitment, and mortality numbers weren't that different. The debris numbers were phenomenally different. And when you put these together to try to get a net accounting, is the forest losing carbon or taking up carbon, it's this debris that makes the difference. So in the Tapajós, we were losing carbon, and I've switched sign conventions because I wear two hats. There's the ecologist hat, which sees it from the perspective of the plants, and then there's the atmospheric scientist, which sees it from the perspective of the atmosphere. So now a negative number means carbon loss, where a minute ago it meant carbon uptake, and I'm sorry, it's a horrible sign convention problem. But the Tapajós was losing carbon, Manaus was taking up carbon. So going back to that question that I started out with, is it a source or a sink? Well, clearly it depends on where you look, and it depends on what the forest looks like. So both of these forests are old growth tropical rainforests that when you look at the satellite images don't look very different, but the satellite can't see coarse woody debris. And it's the coarse woody debris that in this case makes all the difference in the source sink question. So one of the other questions I posed at the beginning was about water limitation. And that's really a critical question because in that Peter Cox model that I showed, it was water limitation that led to the Amazon collapsing. So do we have water limitation here? I talked about water and how it affects the respiration part. I didn't talk about it so much with the photosynthesis. But the short answer is no. There's no water limitation in this forest. What we did to try to get at this was we dug pits. This is a Brazilian agronomist collaborator of mine standing inside one of these beautifully dug pits, and you could see some roots in there. And you don't see too many roots deep down, but there are a lot. They go down about 15 meters. And these plants seem to be able to access deep water. They're not hitting the water table, but they can access deep water. And what we found is that the ratio of ET, evapotranspiration, and again, that's water that's being evaporated through the stomates of the plants and water that's being evaporated from the surface put together, the ratio of evapotranspiration to precipitation was about half. So half of all the water that came in through precipitation went back out through evaporation. And annually, that number was really constant, and it didn't matter how much rainfall came in. It was going to evaporate about half of it. So this was insensitive to incoming precipitation. And looking at it for the dry season, so how much water evaporated during those dry months versus came in, it was bigger than one. And again, there was no variation. Where the only variation, where it went from 1.2 to 1.8, was due to differences in how much water came in. The same amount of water was going out regardless. So the plants weren't feeling any water limitation. And the respiration did have a water limitation. So things on the surface were drying out and weren't able to decompose, but the plants were doing just fine. And like I said at the beginning, this is an interesting place to study this because it's dry. It gets 2 meters of rain a year, but it's dry. It's in the 27th percentile for dryness in the Amazon. So if this dry place in the Amazon has no signs of water limitation for the plants, that's kind of interesting. It's suggesting that these ecosystems are perhaps a little more resilient than we had thought. And since this is a water center talk, I threw in a little more water data just for fun. This is, I've labeled it as energy flux, but it's the latent heat exchange. So it's the water flux. It's the ET number that I just showed. There's a lot of different terminology for that, but it's water exchange during the wet season and during the dry season. So, and then radiation. So the net radiation coming in. And this is the 24-hour average over the wet season and the dry season. And you can see that there's a big diurnal signal. It follows radiation very nicely. And it's bigger during the dry season. A lot bigger. None of the models, in particular Peter Cox's model that projected the Amazon was going to collapse by 2050, had this signal. All of them showed the opposite. They showed the water exchange being higher during the wet season because they thought all the plants were water limited. And they're not, at least not at this site. And like I said, this site's dry. And if we look at this is the evaporative fraction that I've plotted here, and I lost an axis, sorry about that. Net radiation on the X and then the water flux on the Y. So this is how much of the energy coming in is being used to evaporate water. There's no difference seasonally. It's the same. So it's energy that limits the amount of water exchange, not water. And the last thing I wanted to talk about, which it looks like I have enough time to cover, is logging. So I've been talking about this site here. This is a Google Earth image I borrowed. And so this site is an old-growth tropical rainforest, if you will, with its own set of particular characteristics. And down here, there was another tower, which was part of a logging, which was inside a logging concession area. And our site was the control for this logging site. So they made the same measurements that we did at our site, at this other site. And they went in, and the loggers felled about 3.5 trees per hectare, which is not very much. They took out about 15% of the trees with a diameter bigger than 35 centimeters, which amounted to 10% of the above-ground biomass. So this is a high grade, sort of. They went in and they took the trees that they wanted. But this is atypical for Amazonian logging. Usually, they only want those 3.5 trees, but they take everything. because it's a lot easier to just go in there and get rid of everything than it is to plant it and take the trees that you actually want and leave the rest. They also planned a lot with this logging at this site because they cut the vines. These tropical canopies are really connected because the vines go from tree to tree to tree. And if you take out one tree, you're going to take out 15 trees because the canopy is so connected. And with this logging, they cut the vines before they cut the tree. So they actually took out only the 3.5 trees that they meant to. So what this logging did, although it was light logging, it created a lot of this coarse woody debris that I was talking about a minute ago. A lot of the slash was left behind. All the slash was left behind. It tended to be piled a bit, but these 3.5 trees were distributed across the hectare. They weren't just next to each other. The logging also exported a lot of carbon in the form of logs. So some of the carbon left the system that way, but and then the logging also created gaps. So you could see here, this is where they took out one of the trees. You could see that there's a guy left behind there, a subcanopy tree in the middle, but there's a big clearing area there. And like I said, this is not the normal logging that they do in the Amazon. This was an experiment looking at reduced impact logging. And what they found after the logging, so the blue line here is the log site, and the red line is the control site, so the site I had been talking about for the rest of the talk. They found that after the logging, the photosynthesis decreased by about 10%. Not too surprising, they reduced the amount of canopy, so the amount of photosynthesis decreased. And you can see the same thing here with in a ratio form. And there's a lot of variability because there's such seasonality at these sites, but it was a clear decrease in photosynthesis. However, the respiration decreased by 25%. And that's surprising, right? Because I just went on about how important this coarse woody debris is, and it was the coarse woody debris at this control site that was driving the site being a source for carbon, because there was so much of this organic material that was decomposing. Well, here, they increased the amount of coarse woody debris, and the decomposition decreased, the respiration decreased. And that's because, we believe, because the light and the moisture conditions changed, because those gaps in the canopy had been created, and because those vines had been cut down. So it got drier at the forest floor. So although there was more material to be decomposed, it wasn't able to decompose because there wasn't enough water for it to be decomposing. But the plants that were left behind, they were doing just fine. You just gave them more light. They like light, and they're not water limited. So this is a paper we're getting ready to submit to Science. So this is going to be it's a quite dramatic headline. Logging increases carbon uptake in Amazonian rainforests. This isn't normal logging, but it's no more expensive to do this kind of logging than it is to do conventional logging. It just takes planning. So we found more carbon uptake with logging. And I have to end on a somber note, which is a tree fell in the forest. And our experiment died. After several million dollars and an amazing PhD I got to do tromping around these jungles, the tower fell. A tree fell and it took out one of the guy's support wires and it turned into a pretzel. So you could see it wrapping around there. And it's really, really unfortunate, but it meant I got time to write up my PhD. And it's really too bad because this area is changing a lot. There's some deforestation that they're doing. This is across the highway from the site. So they're clearing this land, getting ready to plant their soybeans, which are coming in with a vengeance in this area because there's access to a port. And Cargill has invested a tremendous amount of money in this area to process soybeans. So just a quick summary. We found that this site was a source for carbon to the atmosphere, but we also found that it was a lot more complicated than there's a lot of pieces to this, and scaling up from any one site is really challenging because that site comes with its own peculiarities. We found that both the photosynthesis and respiration had very distinct seasonal patterns, but they weren't driven necessarily by exactly the same things, where the photosynthesis decreased late in the wet season and increased during the mid-dry season in phase with what was going on with the leaves. There were no signs of current water stress on photosynthesis, with evapotranspiration being insensitive to incoming precipitation. The moisture decreased during the dry season when temperatures were highest and moisture was lowest. And the reduced impact logging results that I just showed an increase in carbon uptake over those few years of observations with logging. And I just wanted to end that any changes in temperature and precipitation are going to have huge effects on the ecosystem carbon balance and on these processes, and they could change the distribution of vegetation. But the likelihood of that Amazonian collapse that people thought looked imminent seems a little less clear. So I just wanted to end with some happy pictures after showing all of these negative things. It was a fabulous place to work. There's a great little beach right down the road from our field station. So, thanks.